الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيد المرسلين وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم. Inshallah, we get started. Sorry to interrupt all your conversations. My apologies. My understanding is the topic of this session is institution building. So we pray that Allah Ta'ala gives us tawfiq to say something meaningful and significant. And He over all things has power. His command, when He desires a thing, is but says to it be and it is. And some money. Some tea. So anyway, when we start to talk about building institutions as we are human beings, then the first element is building the individual human being. And in that context, we mentioned last week, I guess, are going to let an African-American male run those corporations unless those people are highly competent. And today, this is a reality. Fannie Mae, Time Warner American Express, Merrill Lynch, and American Express are all headed, the CEOs of all of these operations are African-American males. So how did they ascend to that, to those positions? For example, Chanel, I think, or O'Neill, one or the other, who is head now of Time Warner, AOL, graduated first in his class from Harvard Law School. And by doing that, he got the attention of Nelson Rockefeller. And he became Rockefeller's personal lawyer. And then this translated itself into other opportunities until he ended up where he is now. Now, this is a clear illustration of knowledge leading to power. Because his knowledge that he acquired in school, in law school, opened the doors to more and more influential positions. So we have to develop our minds to take advantage of every opportunity we have. And the more knowledge we have, the more power we potentially have. It's that simple. So don't be satisfied. If you have an associate's degree, go back and get a BA degree. If you have a BA degree, go get a master's degree. If you have a master's, get a PhD. Because now, all right, if you have a master's, you can teach in some universities as an adjunct or possibly even an associate, but you'll never be a department chair. But once you get your PhD, now you can be a department chair. And as a department chair, you can have a disproportionate influence over who that department hires. And when there's an eligible Muslim candidate, you can sway the vote for that candidate. Or if there's an extremely anti-Muslim candidate, you can make sure that that person, their vitae gets vetoed. So this is how we have to start thinking, brothers and sisters. We have to start thinking of how we can position ourselves to make moves that are beneficial for our people, for the Muslims. This is how everyone else thinks. So this is how we should think. We have to start thinking like this. So brothers and sisters, prepare yourself and have a vision. A personal vision, even before your personal vision is necessary, tied into a greater communal vision. Have your personal vision. Go it alone if you have to. Be a pioneer. And aim high. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he encouraged what he called himmatul aliya, to have lofty aspirations. And he hated what he called safsaful umur, like lowly, petty things. He encouraged excellence. He encouraged excellence. So we should constantly look for ways to improve ourselves. Now, intellectual strength also, not only meaning in professional, technical areas, but that's very important. And we should understand, we should begin when we talk about institutions and building institutionalized strength, we should have organizations. And if one of you can take the initiative in doing this, where we begin to identify areas where Muslims can enter en masse and subsequently change certain political, social, economic, organizational landscapes. So what am I talking about? For example, university professorships. Right now is the beginning for now. The next 10 years will be a massive generational change. All of the post-World War II baby boom professors, GI Bill professors, so all of those professors that got their PhDs as a result of the GI Bill and entered into academia, all of this whole generation is reaching retirement age. So there are going to be tremendous openings at this level. So Muslims should begin in an organized fashion to build institutions that identify areas, begin to train people to fill those areas in the most critical aspects or areas of academia. And we can do this if we organize ourselves. So we have programs in place with scholarships, okay. My mother and father will only pay for my education to the BA or BS level. After that, they told me I'm on my own because they want to get another extension on the house and a new car. That's more important than your education. That's cool. We have an organization where we will pay for you to go get your PhD if you've shown promise. And then we have an area that we would like you to go into. We have a school waiting for you that's going to have an opening in 2005 in this department that's consistent with your major, and you're going to fill that opening, inshallah. This is how, if we organize ourselves, this is very easy. The same thing at school teaching, elementary, junior, and high school. New York City has a teacher shortage of 12,000 teachers. 12,000 teachers. Muslims, if we should begin organizing ourselves to fill that void. Because why? New York City, politically, culturally, is one of, if not the most influential city on the face of the earth. Now, if Muslims are in there directly and indirectly shaping the minds of an entire generation of students in New York City, that potentially has huge dividends in the future. So we should begin, like, wherever people are that are teachers, say, look, go to New York City and use your teaching degree. Now, if we've organized ourselves and built the requisite institution, we could easily identify those people and push them towards New York. You graduate next year, good. There's a job waiting for you in New York City. And before you know it, not only do we have a lot of teachers, but now we control the teachers union. Okay? Now we have the curriculum committees, book selection committees are in our hands. So then, so this is power. This is knowledge translating itself into power. But to do this, we need an institutional base. And if one doesn't exist, we have to start developing these. It's absolutely essential. If we're going to live in this country and survive as a distinct people, at every level, we have to start doing this. Police departments, there's a policeman shortage. So we have Muslims that want to be policemen, go to New York City and be a policeman. And again, this in the future can have very positive benefits for us. So anyway, so this is intellectual strength. Intellectual strength is not only in our dunya, in our deen. We have to begin to strengthen ourselves with the knowledge of Islam. Imanan wa islaman wa ihsanan, in belief, worship, and practice. MSAs, we should have, and we're going to try to work on this inshallah in the next 6 months or so. We should have a curriculum for MSAs. You shouldn't come to a college and just hang out at the MSA, go to the meetings on Wednesday night, you know, see if you can meet a possible future wife or husband, and you know, just hang out, do a few programs, see if we could get Hamza Yusuf to come to our school. MSA should be more than that. We should have in the MSA, all right, in the 4 years of your undergraduate studies, you go through a program. You memorize at least 4 juzes of Quran. First year, juz amma. Sophomores, juz tabarak. Juniors, qad sami'a. And seniors, dhariyat. So now you leave with something tangible, with tajweed. With tajweed, and we have tajweed teachers that identify and put a curriculum there. The same fiqh, the first year fiqh al-ibadat, second year fiqh al-mu'amalat al-maliyah, how to buy and sell and loan, etc. The third year talaq wa zawaj, marriage and divorce. Fourth year al-qada wa al-jinayat, the judiciary and criminal law. So now you have something tangible, and this has to be developed, and it's not difficult. It can be done. And then we institutionalize this nationwide. So a person leaves and graduates, not only they have a degree, but they have a credible knowledge, a level of Islamic knowledge, and something tangible. So they look back at their MSA years and they see it as a base that led to bigger and better things in terms of their understanding and application of Islam. And this is how students in other countries do. And in the army, you go in the Egyptian army, you know, they don't teach you how to fight, you might fight them. So at that time, they learn to recite the Quran, memorize Quran. You go in the army in Egypt, you come out as a hafiz. So we're not saying hafiz, you know, this life here is a lot of distractions, it makes memorizing hard, but at least 4 juzes, a juz a year, and a structured program in a group setting that where there's reinforcement and there's a peer situation, competition that makes it easier. So these are some things we should start thinking about, and these are things that, inshallah, will increase our knowledge, and that will translate into power Islamically. We should, and we said, imanan, islaman, wa ihsanan. We should have a regimen that we follow as students of awrad, of words from Quran, etc., so that we have not only talk about in a theoretical sense improving ourselves spiritually, but we engage in regimens and exercises that help us to attain to those objectives. These are things we have to do. Then we're better prepared to go out there and take on the world and to do the lofty things that we aspire to do. So the knowledge should not just be confined to improving ourselves in terms of secular or worldly knowledge, but also in our knowledge of the religion, and this creates a healthy synthesis. And if we're studying systematically, it helps us to see within our various fields of endeavor ways that we can constructively apply Islam. So this is the individual brick in the wall. In terms of institutions, as we said, we should try to identify the areas of greatest need and then look at our resources. And our resources are great. But in assessing our resources, when we say our, we have to decide who we are. Because that goes a long ways towards determining the nature of our institutions. If we are just a lobbying group for various Islamic groups and parties and countries, then we're fools. We're fools because in essence, this is like the tail wagging the dog. I said, man, brother's harsh. I mean it, brothers and sisters. We are potentially one of the most powerful Muslim communities on earth. Even with this, the smallness of our numbers, why do I say this? If we look at every community of Muslims, national communities, and you don't have to believe in nationalism, but I'm just trying to give you points of reference for identity. And we compare ourselves, Muslims in America, with other Muslims. First of all, we're the only Muslim community on earth with 100% literacy. We asked the question at Juma yesterday. We said, are there any illiterate people in this masjid? There are none. Are there any illiterate people in this assembly? There are none. This is the only Muslim community that you could ask this question on earth and get a negative answer. No khatib could stand on a minbar anywhere in the Muslim world and ask, are there any illiterate people out there, and get a negative answer. Some places, most of the people would be illiterate. So this is a distinction for our community. Which means what? That we understand the world in ways most Muslims can't. Because they're denied access to anything over and beyond their personal experiential knowledge, or what's been narrated from them by those in their immediate vicinity. Whereas the world is at our doorsteps. Just grab this book and read about this. Grab this report and read about that. Grab this study and read about this. So this is a distinction for this community. Secondly, if we discount the largesse of government, all right, such as the rapidly disappearing free education that the Kuwaiti gets from their oil-rich government, or that the Saudi gets. If we discount that and we look at personal income and personal earning and income, not what's given by the government, we're the wealthiest Muslim community on earth. We're the wealthiest Muslim community on earth. Now, we're the most literate. We're the wealthiest. And we have the strength of multiculturalism as a reality. I mean, look in this room. You see Muslims from various backgrounds, even in this small assembly. You see Arabs, Pakistanis, Indians, Bengalis, African Americans, possibly European Americans. This is a source of strength. Why? Because the collective experience of many different diverse backgrounds can potentially be brought together and built on. And this is a reflection of the ideal of Islam, the multicultural, multinational, multi-ethnic ideal of Islam. What community on earth besides Hajj can this potential exist? Only here, brothers and sisters. So we have many advantages that by subordinating ourselves to outside Muslim forces, we forfeit those advantages. Because those various communities, they're looking at the world in an ethnocentric perspective. And I'm looking at what's good for the interests of Muslims in Egypt. So now I want to use the Muslims in America to advance that agenda. Right? It's real. I'm looking at the from a Palestinian perspective. And I want to use the Muslims in America to advance that agenda. And I'm not saying the cause or the agenda might be good or bad. I'm not making any judgments. I'm just saying that by nature, the nature of the community limits the perspective. And so our perspective, which is potentially broad and inclusive, becomes narrowed down to a perspective that's narrow and exclusive. And our potential is sacrificed as a result. And so we have to step back and we have to assess the situation if we want to harness that potential so that we can help our brothers and sisters. Otherwise, as we said, if you look at the crises of the last 6 months, what these crises illustrate is that there's been no development. Despite our tremendous potential, we haven't developed ourselves. So despite our educational level, despite our literacy, despite our wealth, despite our multicultural base, we haven't engaged in any development. Right? Now, the crisis of the Gulf War, did we respond to that any differently than the crisis of 9/11 as a community? No different. And it's an indication of the undeveloped nature of our organizations that we get the same advice from leadership. You know, call the president, call the Congress, call somebody. I mean, what is this? Or get emotional, go protest. 9/11 illustrates that we're responding to that crisis the same way we responded to the crisis of the Gulf War. It's no different. And this reflects that we're following institutions, organizations in the Ummah that are undeveloped. And because they're undeveloped, we see these catastrophes that just render us frustrated. Oh, what can I do? Back up and think about it, and you might come up with something. But if you're waiting for someone from overseas to tell you what to do, you're lost. Because they're in the mess they're in because they don't know what to do. So the Gulf War comes, and as an Ummah, all right, rally around whoever's saying Allahu Akbar the loudest. So it doesn't matter Saddam Hussein spent his whole life trying to destroy Islam in Iraq. You know, he put Allahu Akbar on the flag, so he's our hero and our hope, Allahu Akbar. And then when the bombs start falling, just sit back and cry as the Iraqi people are devastated and get frustrated. Oh, what can we do? This is wrong. All right, now the Israelis roll into the West Bank, you know, rally around Arafat. No, it doesn't matter, he's a committed career secularist. He owes the hope of the Ummah. And then the tanks start crushing cars and crushing homes and bulldozing homes and expelling people from their home and shooting people indiscriminately in the street, sit back and get frustrated, oh, what can I do? And so what, we're going to wait 10 years later for the next crisis and be in the same situation? Let's have a rally. Let's go to the UN and rally. It's time to start building the institutions that, okay, look, we just continue our work because we can see where our tactics are progressively bringing us closer and closer towards the implementation of our overall strategy. This is what we have to do, brothers and sisters. This is what we must do. Otherwise, we're wasting our time. We're wasting our time. So we have to begin to engage in this process. And to do this, we must look at what our strengths are. And there are many. And then try to build on those strengths. Try to build on those strengths. Finally, to begin this process, as we said, we have to look at, as we said, the functional basis of power. And in each of these areas, how we can institutionalize ourselves to actualize that power. So if we have wealth, as we do, what sort of institutions can we put in place to do what? For example, develop endowments. So as opposed to just raising money for ad hoc projects, we have money. We have a project here. Let's have a massive nationwide fundraising campaign. We have to start looking at developing endowments to support in an ongoing manner certain areas of work. And once we develop an endowment and we develop on the basis of that initial startup funds, which should be $15, $20, $30 million, then we run those, and that we can raise that kind of money. Muslims in this country spend annually or have disposable income that they spend or save at least $100 billion. At least $100 billion. I mean, you do the math. If there are, they say, 8-9 million Muslims in America. Let's say 10 million, just to make the math easier. If there are 10 million Muslims, and the median income is the median income of the Muslims as a community above or below the national average. Above. So let's say we have 10 million Muslims with a median income of $30,000 a year. How much money is that? 10 million times 30,000. 300 billion dollars. That's what I'm. Now, how much of that do we live on? Let's say we live on 2/3 of it. That leaves $100 billion. That leaves $100 billion. That's more than all of the money the OPEC nations, Muslim OPEC nations, bring in a year. Now, we can't get 20, 30 million of that to start an endowment to do what? An endowment to have a permanent pool, a permanent legal team, a Muslim legal team, that when they're not working, they're engaged in research. Then we have Imam Jamil's case. We don't have to pass the bucket and still not get the $1 million we need to process to defend him adequately. We're a $1 million target. We ended up with $300,000, and of that $300,000, Allahu alam, but the Michael Warren, who's a Muslim, his name is Tariq. He said he's only gotten $30,000, and he put his legal practice on hold for 2 years to defend Imam Jamil. He has a legal practice. He closed it down just for that case. and got $30,000 for 2 years? This is criminal. And then we wonder why the imam's convicted on a weak case full of holes and contradictions. So now, if we had an endowment, and that endowment was just to support a legal team to do research and to defend Muslims, this, we wouldn't have to scramble like this. And then in similar areas of endeavor, education. What do they have here? The National Educational Endowment. Every major private university in this company runs on endowments. And they're multi-billion dollar endowments. You go see how big Yale's endowment is, how big Harvard's endowment is, how big Princeton and Penn's endowment is. They're multi-billion dollars. And then their investment portfolio, the profits on that, the base is either expanding or stable, and then they run the school on the rest. And the tuition, that's just for incidentals. That's for incidentals, the tuition. These are things we can do, brothers and sisters, if we're serious. And to get serious, we have to divorce ourselves from people who aren't serious. We have to divorce ourselves from people who aren't serious. Because time is short. We don't have time for foolishness. We don't have time for foolishness. Someone comes to you, you know, we need the Khalifa, okay, right. That's foolishness. Because unless you're talking about putting the instruments in place to make that a reality, and we're talking about serious institutions, because that's the Khilafah is an institution, and it's not going to materialize in a vacuum. You know, we have Khalifa powder. Just spray it in the air and let the wind blow it around, and if enough people smell it, we'll have a Khalifa. What was the Uthmani state? It was built on institutions. So the Khilafa wasn't just overthrown. These institutions were systematically undermined until it just collapsed. In 1934, it didn't end, it collapsed. But it was eaten apart from inside years before that. At the time of its collapse, the Khalif was just a puppet for what was essentially a secular government. So if we're going to reinstate it, we have to reestablish the institutions that it was built on. And that's hard work. That's work that you can't do with rah-rah and roo-roo and a few tech beers. That takes teams of people working together quietly, consistently, steadily, with firm purpose, well-defined strategy and tactics that are consistent with the realization of that strategy. This is what we have to do. And if we're not willing to do that, we're not serious. And if anyone is not moving in that direction, we shouldn't waste our time. And they say, look, that sounds good, but I think I'll go to night school and learn something else. There's work to be done, brothers and sisters. And unless and until we start doing that work, then we're going to have a hard time. We're going to have a hard time. So to do that, to begin that process, number one, we have to begin to see ourselves as a unique and distinct community. And there's nothing un-Islamic about that. Allah Ta'ala says in the Quran, يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسِ إِنَّا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ مِنْ ذَكَرٍ وَأُنْثَى وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ شُعُوبًا وَقَبَائِلَ لِتَعَارَفُوا. Allah said He made us into nations and tribes. And the African-American context, we're not Africans. And you go, my niece went to Africa and was shattered. Because they told her, you're not an African. You're an American. She was crying. She couldn't even talk about how was Africa. It was all right. She was shattered. But they're right. You can't be in a place for 400 years and then claim that you belong somewhere else. We've been at 400. How long does it take? You know, these people, their people came on with the after the potato famine in 1856 and say it's ours. Right? This is our country. Love it or leave it. You know, this is our country. Where you come from? Where your family from? Warsaw. When they got here? Well, after World War II, after Hitler kicked us out, we came over here. And this your country. We've been here 400 years and don't stake a claim? We're fools. We're fools, brothers and sisters. We have to look at the realities that Allah has put us in, and Allah has put us in these realities for wisdom. Allah doesn't do anything in vain. If Allah wanted us to be Africans, He would have left us in Africa with the brothers and sisters over there. If Allah wanted you to be a Pakistani, He would have left you in Pakistan. You can't even fake it. You got this fake Desi accent. Just speak English. Don't try to fake it. You're an American. He's trying to learn cricket just so he could be a real Pakistani. Brother, go play basketball and give it up. He got more moves than Allen Iverson out trying to learn polo. Allah puts you here for a reason. And that's a common culture. It's a common culture. It's a common culture. You have more in common with your Egyptian peer than with the people back home in the village in outside of Karachi. So we have to look at these realities that Allah has put us in and understand them and then build according to these realities. And then we start cutting across the land. You understand there's a common culture that unites us. There's a common language that unites us. There's a common historical experience that unites us. So we have to start coming together and start and eliminate all these pretenses that we're something Allah Ta'ala has not made us. And then we can start developing. We can start the process of development. And in the light of our unique historical circumstances, in the light of the advantages of literacy, of wealth, that Allah has given us, we can begin to prioritize our agenda, because institutions advance agendas. If you want to take over the world, you build the American Department of Defense, the DOD, right? If you don't want to take over the world, you become Switzerland. We're neutral. No army, no DOD, just leave us alone. We don't bother you, you don't bother us. Right? So the Swiss, they don't have military bases all over the world. They have no global pretenses. So your reality shapes the nature of your institutions. And our Islamic institutions, by and large, are built to accommodate realities that don't exist in this country. And that's why they're so ineffective. So we have to assess, realistically assess, where we are, who we are, what our strengths are, and based on that, what our agenda should be. And then when we do that, we can begin building institutions that are commensurate with those realities. And someone might say, well, brother, you're trying to sell out the Muslim world and this and that. What are we selling out? We're not selling out anyway. What are we doing for the Muslim world? We're not doing anything anyway. So there's nothing to lose. We're crying for the Muslim world, for brothers in Palestine. Those tears aren't helping those brothers and sisters. Those tears are not helping those brothers and sisters. So you might as well just dry up the tears and say, look, I'm going to work. I'm going to work. I'm going to try to pull our Muslim brothers. We're going to make an effective organization to do this. And with the objective that eventually this will do something significantly for our brothers and sisters. And 10 years from now, we won't, when something happens, we won't be demonstrating. We'll be calling people up. We'll be making moves that can effectively alleviate some of the turmoil that exists there. So we're not talking about selling out. We're talking about doing something to significantly impact on the situation. And our struggle and our growth and our development will shape and provide the particulars of that. So, inshallah, I hope that we provided some food for thought. And we're going to stop here because it's late and people are getting tired and sleepy. So we open the floor for some questions and comments and discussion. Inshallah ta'ala. Jazakumullah khairan. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Okay, we have some questions here. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First question is, what is the sunnah and the frequency of doing the night vigil? How many days a week? You do what you can realistically handle on a consistent basis. The most beloved act to Allah is the one that's done consistently, even if it's small. And you should try to do every night a little something. Start half an hour before Fajr. Get up, make wudu, pray two rakats, if time allows, more than that. Read a little Quran and then prepare yourself for Fajr. And as you get used to that, just move back. Half an hour before Fajr, an hour before Fajr, hour and a half, and that's enough. If you get to an hour and a half, that's sufficient. Or getting up a small portion of the night and then possibly sleeping a little after, but it's best if you could do before Fajr. And then do that consistently, and then whatever is easy for you. Everyone has different capabilities and strengths, so the important thing is to be consistent, because the nafs is telling you to sleep. Shaitan is telling you to sleep. And once you break the nafs of that, it's like driving a car, you know. At first, you can barely control the wheel. There's power steering and you turn and you're up on the curb. So you're like this. Then as you get used to it and accustomed to it, then you're a little more relaxed, and then you're down to one hand, then you're down to one finger, then you're down to your knees. So it's a question of becoming accustomed to something until it becomes easy on the nafs. Enjoyment of wealth is beyond just spending on necessities. Can you define this idea? I feel greedy spending money beyond necessity when money is such a big trust. Necessities, there are necessities, and then there are needs. And then there are embellishments. So if one, for example, all right, a necessity in this society for most people is a car. Alright, now, depending on what you do, that car can also encompass a specific need that can be met by a car, which is a necessity, even though you need a pickup truck for that particular job. Then an embellishment would be, as opposed to getting a Ford pickup, you get a Toyota pickup that has, in addition to a wider flatbed in the back, it has stereophonic music system. Now, if a Allah has blessed you with great wealth and has made it easy for you to get the Toyota, then it's no harm in you getting the Toyota, because Allah has blessed you with wealth and this is something Allah has made easy for you to enjoy. You don't have to strain yourself, go into debt, take out a loan to get over and beyond the Ford pickup. So this is an appreciation of the bounty Allah has given you. But when does it become excess? It becomes excessive when that prevents you from fulfilling the obligations over your wealth. So now, instead of getting a Ford, you heard that Mercedes started making a pickup. So the money that you could spend to enjoy over and beyond the basic necessity, you strained yourself. Now there's a need, you can't meet it. We're building a new mosque. You're one of the high income earners in the community. You can't give anything for the mosque. Now you're being excessive. But if you limit yourself to the bare necessities, you might be showing a lack of appreciation for what Allah has blessed you with. So, and you enjoy it. Now, if you're a millionaire, you should drive around in a Mercedes. Because a millionaire driving around in a Mercedes, it doesn't strain you. And you have a lot of money left to use fi sabilillah. So you should enjoy what Allah has given you. You should enjoy what Allah has given you. If you're not a millionaire, you should be content with a Chevrolet. Because by being content with the Chevrolet, you still have money left over to use fi sabilillah. When you get a Mercedes, you're being extravagant because it strains you and it takes money that you can be using for yourself, your education, your children's education, fi sabilillah, for something that's not an essential need for you. So there are a lot of factors you have to balance out in this regard, but you shouldn't feel greedy. If you have, Allah has blessed you with money, and you enjoy that within the limits of Sharia. It's appropriate for you. And if you look at the dowries, why are women given different dowries? Because they have different social and economic standards. And Islam recognizes this. So if you marry someone from a wealthy family, you shouldn't give her the dowry of someone who's living in a very poor situation, because she's from a different social standing and a different economic standing, and she's used to a certain standard. So you should honor that and respect that. And similarly, for those at a higher level or lower situation, this is something Islam acknowledges and something Islam respects. And if you respect that, Allah will increase you, because you're giving thanks. Alhamdulillah, Allah has blessed me. So you're not being extravagant, but you're enjoying those blessings. And Allah says He will increase you in them. So we always look for the balance, though. Wallahu a'lam. This question. There's a third one here. What is a healthy amount of involvement in the problems of the Muslim world? A healthy amount of involvement, I think, is something that can contribute to alleviating the situation, but not so much that we become totally absorbed to the point that we neglect our duty here. And we have a duty here. And doing our duty here, as we said, will help us to eventually do something significant there. So I think a healthy amount is what we can easily do. without tying ourselves down to the extent that we neglect our duties here, our duties in Dawah. I mean, we have a huge opening now. People, the books on Islam can't stay in the bookstores. People are who are active are being invited every day to a church, to a school, to a civic organization. We have to exploit that because this window of opportunity won't be open forever. It won't be open forever. We have intellectual work that we have to do here. So if we're so wrapped up with the problems of Muslim world, and you know how activism can get. You can be literally all over the place. And then the intellectual work that needs to be here. I mean, the right-wing Christians. They're killing us intellectually. They're digging up all these old arguments about the Quran, about the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, about our religion, and they're poisoning people's minds with these. This is a religion of violence. Look, it says fight the infidels, etc. And they're like, this is indiscriminate, no qualification. Fight the infidels, so we have to get them before they get us. They're putting this message out there. This is a religion that subjugates women. Look what it says, and then confine them to their rooms and then beat them. And people are reading this, oh my God, what kind of religion is this? This is a religion of violence and barbarism. And they're putting these messages out there, and there's no effective Muslim response. So right now is good dawah, but when these messages that are being introduced at the level of the intelligentsia go unchecked, eventually these are going to filter down into the popular culture. And you have a popular mythology, because it won't be true, it'll be myth. But mythology is sometimes more powerful than the truth. You have a popular mythology concerning Islam, and at that point people will be locked out from even considering Islam as a viable alternative in their life. So we have to begin addressing those issues and confronting and checking those issues at every level. Otherwise, we'll lose. We have to develop a healthy Islamic culture in this country. Everywhere else, an Islamic culture developed. In other words, the general parameters of Islam shaped various manifestations of culture. So Islam and Arabic shaped the languages. So you have the Islamic language, Urdu or Swahili, and these other languages that aren't Arabic, but they've been shaped and fashioned by Arabic and Islam. Such as Swahili is one of them. This is the language that the Muslims developed along the east coast of Africa, in Kenya and Tanzania primarily, and the coastal areas. And even the name itself is an attribution to the coast. Sahil, Sawahil is the plural, even though it's a grammatical error, because the nisba should always be to the singular. So it'd be Sahili, but it says Sawahili, the language of the coast. And to show you the pervasive influence of Arabic and Islam, right? When the Pan-Africanists, they wanted to get away from the influence of the Muslims and the Arabs, because after all, the Arabs enslaved the Africans. So the story goes. So we don't want anything to do with the Arabs and the Muslims. They're bad. So we're going to make our own religion and our own African religious celebrations. So we're going to make Kwanzaa, right? So we're going to have the pillars of Kwanzaa. Well, brother, what are the pillars of Kwanzaa? Nia. Intention. Yellow teeth. Where did that come from? Came from Africa. Okay. What's another pillar? Imani. Faith. Imani. That sounds kind of familiar. Where did that come from? What's another pillar? Ujamaa. Jamaa. Collectivity. So this shows you the deep influence of Islam on Swahili. So what does this show you? This shows you the cultural shaping of local culture in an Islamic mold. And the same thing for dress, right? The Muslim dress in Indonesia, Malaysia, difference. So that you have the wrap around izara, sarang, whatever they call it, black fez, long mid-thigh shirt, right? In those countries, in Pakistan, Bangladesh, they wear their pajamas. You have the shawar kameez, two-piece long shirt, slit in the middle on the sides, right? Which differs from the Arab, the white jalabiya, and something like this maybe, with the iqal on it. So each area developed, and then the Kurds, right, they had the big baggy pants with the belt around the middle. So each area has its distinct dress that's been, and the African, the beautiful long gowns and the tall ribbed hats and the built up at the cropped at the shoulders, very beautiful, flowing, distinct, nice material. Right? So each area has its distinct code, and the food also. All of these are cultural manifestation, language, clothing, food. You know, the food of Malaysia differs from the food of India, Pakistan differs from the food of the Arabs, which is bland. You can't even get a good rush from that stuff. You know, I want something to make my eyes water. So it differs from the African. They have the fufu, you know, nice rice balls. It's all different, right? The Turkish cuisine, Bosnian cuisine. So each area has its own distinct culture that's been shaped by Islam. So we have to have this here in this country. We have to have our American Islamic culture. We should have, our language should reflect, and this is happening. If you listen to conversation, you know, we're Ak. You know, how you doing, Ak? No, you know, mashallah and inshallah, and you know, that brother's deaning real hard. No, we even have verbs, right, to dean. And one day that should be in Webster's dictionary of English, because it's an Arabic term, but it's applied in a unique English usage, and that should make us when it did to deen, to practice Islam in a serious fashion. You know, and the verbal noun deening, the gerund deening, you know, past tense deened. And that brother deemed real hard right before his death. So this is happening. And it should happen with our clothing. It should happen with our food. So it's American Islamic food shouldn't be, oh, you go to the halal restaurant and get some dal and some, you know, naan and chapatis. We should go and get some collard greens with sheep back in it. And no cornbread with no lard in the mix. And this is how American Islamic cuisine. So all of these things, we should be about the work of encouraging these things consciously. Because why? This will create an indigenous identifiable Islam that the people will be more easily attracted to. Because there's no cultural barrier. There'll be a barrier, but it's not a cultural barrier. So when we come and we're dressed like maybe Alibaba might have looked, now there's a cultural barrier. And we should think about this. So now it's not just the barrier of religion, it's compounded by the barrier of culture. But when they see us looking like them, just clothes are a little baggier, you know, then that barrier is eliminated. So now there's the appeal is based on face value. just for what it is. This, oh, this is Islam, I can consider it on its merits without considering it and then having to consider changing the way I dress drastically, changing the way I eat drastically, changing the way, you know, you could, brother, you could still enjoy a hamburger. You know, just we have halal hamburger. So when we have halal food, we should be thinking of halal hamburger, halal hot dog, and not just halal any kapsa, you know, we have, or halal menseth, or halal maqlouba. You know, that's Palestinian food. We're Americans. So we should have halal hamburger and halal hot dog. So this person that's thinking about Islam, he doesn't have to think about giving up hot dogs. Even if they're halal, you know, that's American, brother, and we're Muslims, you know, don't eat those hot dogs. Why not? He's an American. Brother, keep your hot dogs here, just buy this one from us. So we have to think about these things consciously and across the board. Across the board. So that we can systematically make it easy for people to be Muslims who are holding on to the essentials of the religion. So we're not talking about compromise. If we are, then we could say that the Pakistanis compromise because they don't dress like the Saudis. They're compromising the deen. Africans are compromising Islam. So it's not a question of compromise, it's a question of the universalizing power of Islam that gives it universal appeal, manifesting itself in full in the context that we find ourselves in. Wow, that's a huge tangent. Are protests at all useful? Protests are useful if they're tied into a greater political strategy. So if our strategy is to get as much media attention for the issues of Islam, then the protests can be tied into that strategy. But if we're serious about it, they have to be over and beyond the kind of protests we've been having. We have to incorporate civil disobedience. So in Al Sharpton and Sonny Carson, when they take the streets in New York, no power, no justice, no peace, they're not just shouting no justice, no peace, they're stopping traffic. They're making traffic jams. They're chaining themselves to the doors of City Hall. And now you have a real news story. So it's not a question of the news deciding should we give these people some play. It's a question, man, there's a huge traffic jam. Let's go see who's causing it. Yeah. And they go and see 100 Muslims chain themselves to the toll gates at the Verrazano Bridge and traffic is backed up all the way across Staten Island. So the Action News helicopter's looking at all this track. You know, we're over Staten Island and there's a 12-mile delay. It appears some Muslim extremists have chained themselves to the toll booths. I mean, that's the thing, and they're protesting the conditions in the West Bank. And that's me. So if the protest is tied to a greater strategy, it's useful. But if it's just a protest in and of itself to be protesting, then I don't think it's of much use. And surely Allah knows best. I think all of these were from the sisters. Let's do one from the brothers and then get the rest of the sisters' questions. Brothers' questions over here getting lonely. You told about the curriculum development for MSA, but we have qualified teachers for this. Well, more and more teachers will come in every area, and this is why it's important for the MSAs to work with local resources. I mean, every area you could find a Quran teacher, I'm sure. So the resources exist. We have to tap into the resources and don't confine ourselves to the resources available within the MSA. So we have to look at local, what might exist in the local resources that exist in the local communities also. And then based on the resources in the MSA, local resources, make a program that's that reflects the realities on the ground. But, and this is the importance of organization, by organizing we could develop actual courses of study. We could develop tape sets just for those purposes. So a systematic guide through tajweed, a book and a good tape set, or even a video cassette, etc., or interactive on internet, so you can get actual feedback from a teacher. So at a certain time, when all of these MSAs are meeting, they just get online and there's a teacher in a central location that they can interact with, that can actually correct. All right, now we want this next 20 minutes, all the brothers and sisters at SUNY New Pulse. All right, let me hear you guys say Bismillah. They listen, no. It's not B, it's B. Bismillah. And seem, not so Bismillah. Bismillah. And so, you know, and then there's a lot we can do if we're creative that can overcome the shortcomings we might have. Wallahu al-musta'an. On an individual level, as leader of my MSA, what are the first steps for us to help in building these institutions? I think that start at the individual level. Make sure that everyone has the means and the support network for them to stay in school and to continue to identify with Islam in the process. So make sure that the MSA is open and accommodating. Don't allow sectarian differences to undermine your MSA. Because we're at the level of students, everyone has to be mutually supportive. And the MSA should be for all of the Muslims. The MSA shouldn't just be for the Salafis, for the Sufis, for Hizb al-Tahrir, for Tablighi Jama'ah, for this or that. The MSA should be for all of the Muslims, and the leader of the MSA should make sure it's open for all of the Muslims, so that some Muslims aren't hesitate to get involved with the MSA. They don't hesitate, you know, well, I'm not going to the MSA, you know, it's just for those people. I'm not in the Ikhwan. I don't agree with their methodology. So there's no place for me. Everyone should be comfortable in the MSA. Any Muslim on that campus, Sunni, Shia, Sufi, Salafi, Ikhwani, Hizbi, whatever. And we should work to keep the MSA open like that, so that it can be mutually beneficial. And the MSA becomes an institution in and of itself, that at the very least works to break down the divisions that weaken us. And this is one thing that we have to be mindful of. Sometimes we give our whole life to movements overseas that have failed. You know, if you're everything you're saying, why is such a mess over there? How come you guys aren't running the show over there? Because it's so narrow that they can't get critical mass. So you have a country like Egypt, 10% of the Muslims are secular. But 9% are Ikhwan al-Muslimin, 8% are Salafi, 6% Jihad Islami, 3% Shadhili, 2% Hizb al-Tahrir. So none of them can get beyond the 10% that the secularists have, because they can't come together. So the 9% is not enough, the 8% is not enough, the 6, 7, 5% is not enough. So you have all of these little fingers being dominated by the thumb. When if these fingers got together and made a fist, they could just knock the thumb right off. But this is what's happening in our Muslim countries. And then we adopt that, so we're importing weakness, as opposed to exporting strength. So if we can come together, and starting in the MSA, and then in life after the MSA, to begin breaking down these barriers. Not whatever you're into, that's fine, but we should look at it as something that works for me and makes me a better Muslim. So like we said, I'm a stronger brick in the wall. But we can't see ourselves as being divorced from the wall if all the bricks don't look like me. How many walls are multicolored? Some very nice buildings, right? The bricks, some of them little oranges, little, and you look, wow, that building's nice. So all the bricks don't have to be uniform. There could be bricks of different size, shapes, color, but if every brick is strong, there'll be a strong wall. So the MSH is an institution which should begin to set the trend for other Islamic institutions by at the very least being open and accommodating to all the Muslims, and this is a constructive first step. Wallahu alam, wallahu musta'an. Allah is the source of our help. On the topic of smoking, I understand it's haram, but if it is halal, but is it halal if it is an addiction? Addiction doesn't make something lawful. Something's lawful or unlawful based on its essence or its original ruling. An addiction is even more strongly condemned. So a person who drinks alcohol is sinning. A person who's addicted to alcohol in some narrations and dies in that state dies the death of a mushrik. These narrations. So addictions make something even more strongly forbidden. And I think we should all hold smoking haram. We should all hold smoking haram. Because in the Muslim world, the only fatwa nowadays you get are that it's haram. Because the ones that say it was met, no one said it was sunnah. It's a mubah, not even mubah. Something that has no harm or no thawab and no sin. The people looked at it, it says makruh. It's highly disliked. But the evidence to condemn it isn't strong enough. That was the original ruling. It was makruh. And makruhat are something that's left. No one engaged in makruhat. That's something that on the surface looks like it's haram, but the evidence isn't strong enough to declare it haram. So it's highly disliked. So it should be avoided. And it's something that is rewarded if you avoid it. But it's not, you're not charged with sin if you engage in it. So this is something, but once the medical harm became known, that smoking clearly leads to cancer, clearly leads to lung disease, clearly leads to emphysema, clearly leads to trachea disease, etc., then it was declared haram. Because in Islam, لا ضرر ولا ضرار. There's nothing, no allowance for harmful things or things that reciprocate harm. This is an Islamic principle. So once the medical damage of smoking was known, it was declared to be haram. And even before the medical damage, there are sheikhs like Sheikh Jafar al-Kattani, who was a great Maghribi muhaddith, hafiz of hadith, great alim. He wrote a book condemning smoking as haram before the medical damage. And some of the proofs he brings is that, no, one, that it dirties your mouth, and Islam calls for cleanliness. It offends your neighbors, and Islam calls for you to honor your neighbor. من كان يؤمن بالله واليوم الآخر فليقل خيرا أو ليصمت. That whoever believes in Allah on the last day, let him speak well or remain silent. فَلْيُكْرِمُ دَجَارَ. Let him honor his neighbor. You don't honor your neighbor by blowing smoke in his face. It offends the angels. We have angels around us, recording our deeds, guarding over us. So we're blowing smoke on them. It brings a foul odor to the prayer lines. We're forbidden to eat garlic and onions before we go to pray, right? So what's the difference between garlic breath and Marlboro breath? You know? So garlic, man, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. The whole line will. And then Marlboro breath, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. It's the guy coming to line up with his stuff. Oh man, did I break voodoo? Okay. This is it for the questions. These three. Bi-idhnillah. Allah help us. This question says, one person once raised a question concerning that verse in Surah Baqarah, Allah sealed their hearts, saying, if Allah the Supreme Being sealed their heart, how can a humble human being accept the blessing of Islam? The person whose heart is sealed is not humble. His or her heart was sealed only after they arrogantly and repeatedly rejected the opportunities to accept Islam. And then Allah sealed their hearts. So that indicates that they weren't humble from the beginning. So we shall jazat min jins al-amal, that the recompense from Allah is consistent with the servant's actions. So the servant blocked off Islam from his heart, and then Allah responded and blocked his heart. But Allah didn't initially block his heart. What do you think of the first concrete, what do you think the first concrete step should be towards mobilization of a group towards building an institute to support education, K and up? I think that a first concrete step would be to identify people who are already in the educational field and then unite them, get in touch with them, put a call out, advertise in Islamic Horizons or whatever, and develop a plan to bring those people together, use their collective intellectual and financial resources to start mobilizing towards doing something, some kind of systematic effort to improve education in this field. And also look at existing models. Look at what non-Muslims are doing. Look what Jewish groups are doing, and how they go about socializing their children into a commitment to their religion at the earliest ages. What institutions do they have? One institution they have are the summer camps. Literally tens of thousands of Jewish children go to summer camp every year. And the camps are by and large ideological. They systematically introduce certain ideological themes that will make those children committed and allow them to have fun. We lose a lot of our children because they say Islam isn't fun. See, I went to Islamic school, they don't even have rec. And the public school I was in, all day was rec. So does it have to be feast or famine? So we have to start looking at what is working with other groups and then try to replicate those institutions with an Islamic flavor. And this is something that the Muslims have always done. These are not things, these are not bid'ahs. Umar radiallahu anhu, when he saw the Persian administration, the Diwan and Dawaween, this came from the Persians and the Romans. Muawiyah, if you look, all the Syrian Christians were running the administrative apparatus of the state in Damascus. And when the Abbasids moved to Baghdad, it was the Persians. The Baramika that were brought in as the Wuzara, these were Persians who had long experience in state bureaucracy. And the Muslims saw this and saw that it was efficient and it worked, and they adopted it. So we have to look in education and all of these, what's working out there? There are a lot of progressive, positive things we can adapt. So we don't necessarily have to reinvent the wheel to begin the process of institutionalization. Say you're building an American up in America, but don't we need to first know and learn our deen with Aqidah in America? Of course. No, we have to learn Aqidah, Fiqh, Ihsan. We have to learn all of these things. Or anywhere you could learn it so that we can build up. And if it, anywhere you could learn, if that means going overseas, some of us have to go overseas. But we have to go overseas with the idea of coming back here and then building our own Islamic educational institutions so that those masses of people who can't go overseas for very real reasons can still study their religion in a systematic way. So we have to go overseas with a plan and not just up and go, because if we up and go, we might come back with nothing. We go with nothing and come back with nothing. But we were essentially tourists. So we had a nice time over there in wherever, Syria or Yemen. Got to see all the sites and visit all the historic sites and visit the Sahaba and everything else. But we might not have accomplished much. So we need a plan. We have to go over with a plan. Or we go over and accomplish a lot, but because there's no plan, come back and are worthless, of no benefit to the community, because there is no plan to integrate the student back into the community. So the student comes back and ends up driving a cab, or just telling everyone what bad Muslims they are, and that's the end of their benefit. So we have to begin to start even planning when we do that, when we go overseas, planning in terms of who should go. Some people shouldn't even go. I mean, here's someone flunked out of French, so study Spanish, flunked Spanish, hates languages. What makes them think they're going to be able to learn Arabic? Well, you have to study all this grammar, and then even if you know the grammar, there's a million vocabulary words. You have to study. So they got bored with Spanish. How are you going to learn all this Arabic vocabulary? You couldn't discipline yourself to get beyond yani whatever in Spanish. There are 500 words in Arabic for lion. So one scholar wrote a book. There are 500 words for lion. Asad, Usama, etc. Qaswara, Dirgham, Gandafar, etc. So if a person couldn't learn 5 different animals in French, how are they going to go and learn 500 different names for a lion in Arabic? So some people shouldn't waste their time. You say, brother, you know, alhamdulillah. There are doctors here that say, you know, I want to just quit and go study in Damascus. Say, why? Allah put you in a position to be a doctor. You should be a doctor. If you want to do something for the deen, graduate and practice a few years, learn as much as you can learn, then make a Muslim Doctors Without Borders if you want some excitement. And now why should we have Christian Doctors Without Borders going to Muslims? We have all these Muslim doctors that say they want excitement, so there's plenty of excitement. They want to do something for the deen, that would be extremely beneficial for the deen. And if you're serious about it, you could learn Arabic here. I mean, they have schools of Orientalists learning Arabic at Princeton and Harvard and Yale and University of Chicago. Never left America, and they're picking up books, reading, translating. Never left America. But the American Muslim thinks he or she has to go halfway around the world to learn Arabic. This is, if you're serious, you'll learn it wherever you are. Because you'll do whatever is necessary to learn it. And maybe in the process learn something else that might be more beneficial to the Muslims. So whatever Allah has facilitated for you, that's what you should be doing. If Allah facilitated you going to med school, take advantage of that. Because by taking advantage of that, not only can you, if you're creative, you can do a lot of things. You want to introduce traditional medicine. If you're an established doctor in regular medical practice, when you talk about alternatives, that's goes a lot further than your uncle, the Hakim from Lahore, who comes to tell someone about herbal medicine. Say, well, who's this old man? He's a Hakim. That means wise. from Lahore. He has an herbal treatment for corns. I don't know. I'm not gonna take that. As the federal drug and whoever they are approved this. So there are a lot of what, but if you come and you take everything your uncle knows, and then you go as Dr. So-and-so with a well-developed proposal for alternative medicines, and you situate it within the reigning paradigm, then it goes a lot further. So if you even want to do some creative things, then by being established within the existing system, you could do a lot of things. And then you have to realize also there's some things that you can't cure with herbal medicine. So it's one thing to romanticize about alternative medicine and about this, that, and the other, but if someone needs a bypass operation, you know, the Hakim can't help them. And if you dropped out of medical school, you can't help them either. If our sisters are victimized by doctors who are quick to give cesarean sections, and our sister dropped out of medical school because, you know, she didn't feel comfortable around all these guys in hijab for those 2 or 3 years, then it's over, then you're not going to help our sister either. So we have to have people that make the sacrifices to put themselves in a position to help Muslims. To help Muslims. And that involves a sacrifice. But if Allah facilitates that for you, that's where your spiritual opening is going to be also. Because sometimes they say your spiritual opening lies in taslim, and it doesn't lie in tajreed. So it lies in your submitting to what Allah has placed you in, and not in divesting yourself from the world. If Allah is putting you in the world, then in the world you're going to find your spiritual opening. And if you take yourself out when Allah is putting you in, you're only going to find difficulty and hardship. So you have to understand the time that you live in, and the ruling for the time of your life that Allah has put you in. This is what Imam Shafi is saying, rahimahullah, al-waqt kas-saif, illam taqta'ahu qata'ak. That the time is like a sword. If you don't cut it off, it cuts you off. This isn't about wasting time. This is saying that you have to understand the ruling of the time. Because if you go against it, you're going to get cut. But if you go with it, you'll always stay ahead of the blade. So if Allah facilitated you to do something and made it easy for you to do that, and then you try to go against that, you're going to get cut. You're going to get hurt. So if Allah made it easy for you to go overseas and study Islam, that's what you should do. And if you go against that, you might get in trouble. On the other hand, if Allah made it easy for you to do something else, and you leave that and then go against that, you're going to go against the sword. And you'll find only difficulty compounded by difficulty. And so by admitting, Allah, this is what you want me to do. It's clear to me. You've made it easy for me. Bismillah. And you'll find that in the course of doing that, the spiritual mysteries will unfold before you. You'll see the manifestations of Allah's tawheed and power in everything that you do. And that will give you your spiritual opening. والله المستعان والحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم الله يبارك فيك
الله يتقبل منكم
وزاد من أمثالكم وبارك الله
السلام عليكم.